Accession number 34702, Reel 4.
Dana, Reel 4. So you mentioned that the Harvard was a lot more powerful. Was there any other elements to it that differed from the Stearman?
Well, it was a monoplane, of course, which was a big difference. Otherwise, no, it was, as I just said, more powerful, bigger aeroplane. And
did it have a fixed undercarriage?
No, it had a retractable undercarriage.
So, again, the process starts again, does it? Do you have to familiarise yourself with the aircraft with an instructor?
Yep. Yeah, you go through the introduction, air experience, effective controls and all the rest of it. Then you do the climbing, descending, turns and all the rest of it. But obviously you can assimilate quicker, having completed the course on the other aircraft.
Did it have a variable pitch propeller at all, the Harvard?
I believe it did, yes, if I remember rightly, yes. It's a long time ago, so I'm not quite sure, but I seem to think it did, yes.
Would you have to do then, as you move on to the advanced thing, would there be much more involvement in things that before you flew the aircraft, checking it over properly, and would you have to sign anything at all?
To sign. This is to certify that Eric Denham has received instruction on action in the event of fire and abandoning of aircraft as pertains to the AT-6A aircraft. In other words, we've got instruction how to bail out and all the rest of it.
So when you were given instruction on that, was that again classroom based?
Yes,
you would have learnt that thing. I was thinking actually it could
be on the flight line, I think, but it was by one of the instructors.
I was thinking more along the lines of when you actually first go out and do your initial checks with the aircraft, would you have to sign for that aircraft?
Before you fly, you sign the authorisation book first, which has been filled in either by yourself or, if in this case, by an instructor as to why you're going, what you're going to do. And he authorises the trip then, and then you sign. And then normally with RAF aircraft, it was a Form 700 you signed, taking over the aircraft, having checked various things in it, which have been done by the ground crew, of course. They had a flight dispatcher section here where you went to for all this sort of thing.
And with the way that this part of the course was evolved, with the more time for you, as flying the aircraft on your own rather than dual instruction, was that more the case with the advanced?
Yes, I probably didn't have to do quite so many hours before going solo. But otherwise, you did all the same sort of thing, but including instrument flying and navigation trips and the handling side of it, steep turns and stalling and low flying, forced landings, all that sort of stuff.
With your navigation exercises, did they occur over a wider area though this time? Because you mentioned with the Stearman it was fairly short.
Yeah, it was basically around Florida, over the Everglades and south, and round, and in Florida itself, you didn't normally go out of there at this stage. But you were either doing it initially dual and then solo. We were doing more and more flying then, but of course, was coming now into using the radio range system, which they had in America, which was we didn't have in this country. It was system of radio signals which went out in certain directions, and you could fly along the arms of these things from one to another, and you didn't have to really do any much navigation as such. But we were discouraged from doing that on the normal nav training. It was more the map reading and things like that.
With the radio range thing, how did that work then? How do you know you're on the right track?
Because you were picking up this beam on your radio receiver, and it was identified by a call sign, and they were printed on the map, so you could then fly from one leg to another if you wanted to fly that way. And that was the way American aircraft flew in, mostly in the, because it's a much larger country, of course, and they needed some better method of navigation than we were using. But it was only in America, it wasn't universal, so we couldn't use it when we came back to this country anyway.
Would it have been useful if you'd have got lost or something like that? Is that the
Yes, I suppose so. Yes, you could get tuned into the right frequency and pick up that particular radio range, yes.
Did you, in the advanced training, start to do any sort of formation flying at all?
We did, yes. We did formation flying as part of the training.
Can you tell me, Eric, about formation flying and how you formate on another aircraft and how you sort of maintain the position you're in?
Well, you just manoeuvre yourself to, usually, to be level with, or just behind, the wing of the lead aircraft by use of throttle and controls, and to maintain your position. So you're continually altering the power and adjusting the controls to stay where you want to be, either behind or on the wing or wherever it was.
And are these delicate manoeuvres when you're in line?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What type of numbers of aircraft would you formate on?
Usually three. We did that. Later on, I think we did that at the end of the course, to the fly past and that sort of thing. I think I've got some photos, but I think they're upstairs somewhere.
So how did this section then pan out with the advanced training? Were there any other elements that they started to introduce, maybe, that you'd not done with the steerman?
Well, there was the formation flying, as you say. You can see quite a lot of formation flying here. Three aircraft. Why so much emphasis on it, I don't know, because it didn't really have much of a tactical advantage. Radio range, as I've already talked about before. Map reading, aerobatics again, of course. Navigation. And then at the end of the course we did two cadets flying together, alternating with you, sometimes with you, the pilot, sometimes you were the navigator. So you sat in the back doing the navigation.
So would that be on a cross country then?
Yes. Yes. I think from the last trips we did a longer one into other parts of the country, up to somewhere or other. I can't remember exactly now, but we did a final
So was that an
long trip?
An overnight stay then that you would have done?
Yes, looks like, yes.
I noticed on there as well that you've done some air-to-air gunnery at the final part of that course.
Air-to-ground gunnery, yes. We didn't actually fire anything because we didn't have any weapons. It was just simulated going as the target on the ground.
So is that just a case of the approach, really, to...
Yes.
...to that sort of thing?
Yes.
So when did you finish the advanced training, then?
Well, that finished in... July, 30th of July, 1943. So you can see we've already gone 2 years before I got my wings.
And was it at that stage where you actually receive your wings?
Yes.
Is there a sort of, again, a parade or something of that order?
Yeah, we just paraded and the wing commander gave us there was no particular celebration as such. I made a picture taken, I think, and that was it. Then some were commissioned and some of us weren't, of course. Most of them then became sergeant pilots and some of them were pilot officers.
Was there any sort of logic to that commissioning procedure?
No, I don't think so. In those days it was pretty arbitrary, I think.
So at that stage you're a flight sergeant, are you?
Sergeant pilot, yeah. And it was back to Moncton again. And waiting then for a trip back home, which was on the Queen Elizabeth.
I imagine then that was quite a quick passage, was it, for you to return back?
Yes, but at that time, 1943, of course, a lot of American troops were starting to pile into this country, so the ship was pretty full. There were six of us in a single cabin, which had been converted to take... There were 12 of us, that's right. There were six bunks, so you had to bunk one night, and the next night you found somewhere else to sleep, anywhere you could, with your life jacket as a pillow sort of thing. But I think we came across pretty quickly in about 3 days, yeah, the Queen Elizabeth. And then once again it was back into the holding situation at Harrogate, number 7 PRC at Harrogate. All aircrew coming back went there to await the next stage of training or whatever.
Had there been any sort of assessment of your abilities throughout the course, rather than just flying, as to where you might be posted next and the type of pilot you might become?
Not really, no. No, you were just assessed as a pilot at the end of the course, below average or above average or whatever, mostly average, of course, which was myself. And, the majority of people coming back then were going into Bomber Command eventually, because that was where most of the action was at that time, 1943. But to do that, you had to go then to a multi-engine training. And that was what I was waiting for then, and it was a long wait.
How long were you at Harrogate?
Well, initially went there the 19th of September, 43. And I went on various detachments. I didn't eventually go to the advanced flying unit until 18th of the 3rd, 44. So that was over a year. No, not, well, 43, September 43 to March 44.
So 6 months.
6 months.
So how did you fill that time in that?
Well, according to my logbook here, I went to Brough again for another 12 hours on the Tiger Moth. Why, I don't know. Just to keep them going, I think.
Is that just to keep up the almost as well you're flying out?
I suppose so, yes. Or to keep the place going, I don't know which. Then I went to Doncaster Airport in air traffic control.
What did that involve then?
I went to... It didn't involve very much, really. They operated from Hanley Page Harrows from there, which went up to the islands, delivering vegetables and things like that. And I was in the control tower, but I didn't have a particular function. It was just things they did to get rid of you and keep you employed. And I went to Whitley Bay on the RAF regiment course.
So what did that involve?
Oh, that was typical RAF regiment stuff. Running around, shooting at things and getting money and hiding in ditches and pretending to be soldiers. Which, did, as you can imagine, didn't go down very well with aircrew.
Was there an element of frustration at this point?
Oh, yes, very much so. You could see it in Harrogate, I mean... There were two places at Harrogate, the Majestic and the Grand, were the two big places in Harrogate, and they almost had mutiny at times. It was because they were trying to keep people occupied again by cross-country running and Morse code training, all that sort of thing. And by this time, people had had enough and they were just weren't going, they were skiving off. You could go into the cinema in the afternoon and be full of RAF pilot officers and sergeant pilots, and you'd come out and the RAF police would be out there, but they couldn't do anything. It was a very frustrating time, yes. I mean, it had taken all this time to get to the stage of getting your wings, and it was taking even longer outing to do anything productive.
I take it as well, when you'd arrived home, had you been given some leave as well to visit?
Oh yes, you had some leave, yes. I had a couple of weeks leave, I think, when I got home. Yeah. But I went home to York. And eventually, I did get the course at Banff in Scotland, on Oxford's, for conversion from single engine to multi-engine.
Tell me about that, then. What did you have to do when you went up there, then?
Well, the difference between, you know, just having one engine at the front and having two engines, manoeuvring and things like that, it was flying on one engine if one engine failed. And it was all new stuff, of course, things like that.
How does it differ then with a twin-engined aircraft to a single-engined aircraft in how it handles and how it flies?
Well, basically, it's the same. It it was just another stage in getting from a single-engine aircraft to a multi-engine. You know, from it was a four-engine bomber, taxiing, used engines for taxi, that sort of thing.
What was the Oxford like as an aircraft?
Oh, lovely aircraft, yes, yes. That was 19. That's a bat flight. That was later on. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me about the course then.
Well, it was just the same sort of stuff again. You know, where you did the turns and flying, descending and climbing and steep turns. Landings and flying on one engine and things would come now to things like flapless landings and navigation, etc.
What's a flapless landing?
Well, the flaps, with flaps down, you can come down to a lower speed, of course. With flapless, you'd have to land at a higher speed. We also did beam approach training there as well, with the old beam system.
How did that work?
Beam approach. Well, you had a receiver that you heard, and you heard signals in both ears, and if you went on one side of the beam, you heard it in your left ear. One side, you heard it in your right ear. If you were right on the beam, you heard it in both ears, equal. So you knew you were on the beam then. And you could fly down this beam to land, not exactly blind landing, but to get you down to the ground, near to the ground where you could see to land. Some were so good at it, the instructors, that they could do blind landings with it, but it was a method of, before ILS and radar, a method of getting you down towards the runway, close to the ground, by, we really couldn't see the ground, in other words.
I was going to say as well, obviously, the big difference between this type of flying and the flying that you've done before is obviously the weather issue, isn't it? So what was it like? Were you having to acclimatise to flying in sort of like European conditions when you went to that?
I suppose we were, yes, yes.
Because I would assume that clouds and rain became much more of an issue than they had done while you were in Florida.
Yes. Yes, the weather, I mean, it was... Actually, it was reasonable weather because it was summertime when I did it. But obviously, if you were in the winter time, it would have been rather different. We also did something called camera obscura, which is rather a complicated thing, like bombing, but you don't actually bomb. You fly over and over like a caravan it was, I think, where they could plot your movement on there and where you'd drop your bombs and whether you would hit the target or not.
So from your point of view, it's just doing the approach to it, is it? And at that point where you would drop your bomb.
Yeah.
But they're tracking it on the ground.
That's right. Yes.
Can you give me a sort of thumbnail sketch as well, Eric? You obviously mentioned that the Oxford was a lovely aircraft, but can you sort of give me a kind of description of it, as what it was like?
Well, it was a two-seater at the front, and in the fuselage it could hold several passengers if necessary, if it was fitted up that way. Had been used as a civilian... Oh, its forerunner had been a civilian aircraft, I think. Very similar to the Anson, which, of course, was another aircraft of the same sort of thing, propeller-driven. Why the Oxford was selected for this purpose, I don't know, but it served its purpose of... transiting you from a single engine, which would eventually through to a four engine sort of thing.
And how did it handle?
It handled very well, yes. We even did formation flying in it, I see. So it must have handled quite well. And then from there, I expected to go to... a heavy conversion unit, Lancaster's or Halifax or something like that. But the posting at the end came somewhat out of the blue and posted me to number 2 Air Gunnery School at Dalcross in Scotland and further along the coast, just outside Inverness, as a staff pilot.
What did that involve then?
Hmm?
What did that involve?
Well, I didn't know till I got there, but when I got there I found out it was a school that was training air gunners on a 6-week 6 weeks course, I think they did, to become an air gunner. And it was training them. And one aspect of the training was they had to fire rounds at a drogue target. And you need an aircraft to pull that drogue along. And that was me in the martinet pulling the drogue around while these UT air gunners in an Anson were below, mid upper turret facing backwards and looking at this drogue and shooting at it, trying to hit it. And the way they distinguished who'd hit it, if anybody, was that the rounds were loaded, but they were tipped with paint, different coloured paint, so many rounds per student. And then we would, after they'd finished the exercise, we would fly back over the airfield, release the drogue, would be picked up off the ground, and then somebody would assess it. And the other aspect of their training was cine camera gun training. They had a cine camera in the turret, which was with the gun sight, and we used to do simulated attacks on them, high quarter attacks on low quarters and that sort of thing, and they would shoot us down by the camera, hopefully, not the guns. So that was two jobs we did, and we'd do 3 or 4 trips a day like that, about an hour and a bit at a time over the Moray Firth.
When you were towing the drogue, would you be in more or less straight and level flight then?
Yes, and the aircraft underneath would weave, so somebody sitting in the turret would appear that the target was moving around.